Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
Back in May, a fresh round of fighting broke out between Israel and the Palestinians. Over the course of a week and a half, Israel went to war with the militant Hamas movement in a broad conflict that was punctuated by missile barrages against Israeli population centers and repeated Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip. The media was quick to frame the fighting as just the latest round in a cycle of violence between Israel and the Palestinians. And on the surface, the conflict was indeed driven by fresh Israeli-Palestinian frictions over things like denial of access to parts of Jerusalem, as well as controversial Israeli court decisions relating to property ownership by Israeli Arabs. But behind the scenes, the conflict was being propelled by Iranian influence, by volatile Palestinian politics, mixed signals from the United States, and the machinations of other regional actors. To get some insights into those stories, as well as the media's role in the broader conflict, I turn to Jonathan Shanzer. John is Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a leading DC think tank. An expert in Arab and Gulf affairs, he previously worked as a terrorism finance analyst at the U.S. Treasury Department and at think tanks like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the Middle East Forum. A prolific author, he has written four books on the Middle East. The latest is Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War, which has just been published by FDD Press. John, it's terrific to have you on. Let's begin with your book. One of its central themes is that there was a glaring disconnect between what was actually happening on the ground and how the conflict was being portrayed in the world media. Can you talk about that misalignment a little bit? Where did journalists and reporters miss the mark, in your estimation?
What I'll just say to start is that I watched the war on Israeli and Arabic television throughout. And to say that there was a bias or to say that there was fake news, I think doesn't cover it. I'm not sure, by the way, that either one of those terms are particularly helpful. What I would say was that the editorial choices really jumped out at me, that the decision on the part of most of our networks, cable networks in particular, to focus on the war as just another round of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict really jumped out at me because I don't think that was the case. And we can talk about that if you'd like. But then there were like the moments where there would be a major event taking place on the ground in Israel, and it just simply didn't get covered at all. So for example, second day of the war, a mortar round fired out of the Gaza Strip, probably by Hamas, but maybe by another group, somehow hits the Ashkelon pipeline area and actually blows up a tank that had been filled with gas, and there were fireballs reaching high into the air. And that didn't make it onto American networks. And I don't think it was covered a whole lot, even in the written coverage. But what I saw instead were allegations of Israeli war crimes, discussions of Israel using disproportionate force, even as this projectile causes immense damage to the nerve center of Israel's energy infrastructure. So that's just one example of the sort of choices that we saw during the war. Maybe another important moment or two important moments to focus on. One was, you may recall, there was a moment where the IDF announced that there were troops on the ground fighting in the Gaza Strip. It was a tweet that came out in both English and in Hebrew. And I remember running to the TV saying, I can't believe this is happening, knowing that then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was a bit risk averse and was really not interested in long involved conflicts with ground troops. And the Israeli press was not able to confirm these reports. And yet it was reported here in the United States as fact. As it turns out, the Israelis had intended to message this to Hamas, not to necessarily the Western press. Hamas sent its commandos, Iranian-trained commandos, into the tunnel system that the Israelis had come to call the metro of Gaza. They filled the tunnels, then the Israelis started bombing the tunnels, and it actually looked like a successful information operation that the Israelis had carried out, but the American press was furious that they had reported this as fact when it wasn't. They were forced to retract. But what was so remarkable to me was that had they just turned on Israeli television, had they just checked with their colleagues in the Israeli press, they may have been able to save that embarrassment. But again, it was about the choices that they made. It was about the decisions that they made throughout where I saw a lot of erroneous coverage, unforced errors. Maybe the last episode that I'll mention is there was probably one of the more dramatic moments of the conflict. Israel bombed a building called the Al-Jala Tower, and the Israelis knocked out this building. At the time, they said there were security reasons they needed to do it. There was a Hamas presence there. Turns out that this was the building that housed the Associated Press, as well as Al Jazeera. So they vacated the building, they destroyed it, at which point the Israelis came under immense attack from really a number of media outlets, not just AP and not just Al Jazeera, where they were being accused of trying to quash the coverage of the war. They were being accused of trying to disrupt media operations during the war. The implication was that Israel didn't want people to know what was happening in the Gaza Strip. Well, it turns out, and the Israelis have actually shown the intelligence to the White House, and the White House is apparently satisfied with the intelligence, that there was a Hamas office inside the building. And the Hamas office was being used to jam Iron Dome, to jam this missile defense system that had saved thousands of lives over this round of conflict and the three prior rounds of conflict. And what was sort of amazing to me was that the AP and Al Jazeera never actually talked about what they knew or didn't know about who was in the building, what they were doing. Of course, we don't expect Hamas to have a sign up saying Hamas air defense jamming system, fifth floor. But there was kind of a moment where you're wondering, well, could they at least acknowledge that this was in the building and that perhaps all of the screaming and howling about Israel trying to quash coverage, maybe they could walk that back a bit, but they didn't. And so there were just a lot of interesting moments like that during the war. And they were really what prompted me to go and write this book, because I felt like the coverage we had in the U.S. was vastly different from what I saw coming out of the region.
What you're describing, though, isn't really a new process. Because all too often, what we hear about in the media has been the long-standing cycle of violence between Israel and the Palestinians and how it's resurfaced yet again. There's certainly some truth to that. But you make the case in the book, and you've made the case here, that the driving dynamics of the latest conflict were much more complex. Talk about that a little bit more. What were those dynamics, and who were the main players in this conflict?
You know, the first thing to say is that the Arab-Israeli conflict is not what it was. The Arab-Israeli conflict is shrinking. We saw that last year with the signing of the Abraham Accords. UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan all made peace with Israel. And then prior to that, we had seen the Jordanians and Egyptians do the same. So what we have is a smaller kind of piece of the Arab world that still views Israel with hostility. And by the way, there are many other countries that have quiet, normalized ties with Israel. So it's not the Arab-Israeli conflict, not anymore. Then there's the question of, is it the Palestinian-Israeli conflict? And with that, you have to just take a look at the fact that there are two Palestinian territories, West Bank, Gaza Strip. West Bank was not at war with Israel. West Bank was quiet during this round of conflict. So is it the Palestinian-Israeli conflict? I'm not sure we can call it that. There were Palestinian groups that were fighting, but then you have to ask yourself, how did they get the weapons? Where did they get their training? Where did they get the funding? Where did they get their support? And with all of that, we can point to really four actors that I think are worth unpacking here. First and foremost, the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the number one financier, trainer, armor of Hamas over the years. This began in the late 1990s. It has been constant throughout the last several decades. A couple of moments here and there where there was some tension and maybe some of that support ebbed. But by and large, I think you got to point to Iran as the foremost sponsor of Hamas, as well as some of the other groups that are active in the Gaza Strip. In addition, we can look at the financing that comes out of Qatar, a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, of which Hamas is a splinter movement. You've got the Erdogan government in Turkey that also has been a champion of Hamas. In fact, people point today to Turkey as the second largest jurisdiction for Hamas operatives in the world, other than the Gaza Strip. And then finally, there's Malaysia, which plays a minor role in all of this, but there have been a number of engineers and students, people who've been developing weapons for Hamas, who have actually been gunned down, presumably by the Mossad on the streets of Malaysia. And this we've been able to track over the years. But the Hamas-Iran dynamic is, I think, probably the most important one to focus on for the purposes of our discussion. And the reason is that there's a conflict that's taking place across the entire Middle East. And it's been going on really for decades, but over the last 8 or 9 years, we've really seen it come into focus. And what we're looking at basically is a dynamic in which the Israelis have been hit by Iranian proxies for as long as they can remember. Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And the Israelis have never responded to the patron of those groups in the past, right? They would just fight these proxies and take it on the chin, and Iran sort of kept its nose clean from afar. As the Iranians began to develop their nuclear program, and as they were exploiting the chaos in places like Syria and Yemen and Iraq, the Israelis kind of said, you know what? The days of impunity are over. And they launched what is now known as the War Between Wars. And they have been waging an asymmetric campaign in response to Iranian aggression all over the Middle East. So that's striking weapons transfers in Syria. It's taking out IRGC operatives in Syria. It's attacking Iranian ships that are involved in military activity on the Mediterranean, in the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman. They've attacked Iranian nuclear scientists on the ground in Iran itself. They've taken out Al-Qaeda operatives that have sought refuge in Iran. And the goal with all of this has been to erode Iran's strength asymmetrically and to expose their activities in the process. Now, this war between wars has frustrated Iran. It's been very clear that they're not happy about how this has all played out. And I think we have to look at this most recent round of conflict as part of this broader asymmetric conflict that's been going on over at least the last decade, if not more. Iran was cheering on the war. We saw their fingerprints on the weapons, on the training, on the tunnels, on the drones. Everything that we saw during this war had Iranian kind of DNA in it. And so I think it needs to be viewed in that larger context. And I think that very few people did.
All right. Let me shift gears here for a second, because I'm cognizant of the old saying that all politics is local, and it applies to the conflict here as well. What we saw in the spring came against the backdrop of internal Palestinian political jockeying, and it was precipitated by conflicting signals that came out of the new Biden administration in Washington. Can you talk about those factors too?
So first, when we talk about how this conflict erupted, you know, you asked me before about some of the erroneous or curious media coverage. Most of the major outlets pointed to a real estate dispute that was something like 80 years old in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Eastern Jerusalem. The story there, just very briefly, is that there were Jews that bought real estate in East Jerusalem before the founding of the state in 1948. When the war broke out in 1948-49, the Israelis lost that territory. Arabs moved in, lived in those homes, and the Israelis reconquered the territory in 67, the 1967 Six-Day War. And it was at that point that the original owners or their families began a legal effort to try to recoup the real estate. Those court cases wound their way through the Israeli courts for decades, and they were about to hear a decision within a few weeks of when the conflict erupted. And the way that it was described here and around the world was that Israel was about to evict Arab residents of East Jerusalem without any of that context. But by the way, the idea somehow that real estate disputes cause wars was a very strange way of framing the conflict. I mean, just to be clear, guns cause wars, bombs cause wars, mortars, missiles cause wars, not real estate disputes. Real estate disputes
wind their way through courts. And, you know, you may not like what happens. You may not like the verdict, but they don't cause wars, right? People cause wars. So that was the way that it was framed. But then what really drove me crazy, and this gets back to your question of the local politics and how they played out. The month before the war, there was a very dramatic thing that took place in the Palestinian political arena, and that was the cancellation of Palestinian elections. Now, the story behind it was that when the Abraham Accords were signed in 2020, the Palestinians across the political divide, you have to remember the Palestinians have been at war with one another since 2007. You've got the PLO in control of the West Bank. You've got Hamas in control of the Gaza Strip, and they have been at war with one another since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip by force in 2007, rendering the Palestinian people bitterly divided. Now, when the Abraham Accords were signed, the two warring factions looked at one another and they said, you know what? We're divided and we're losing the support of the Arab world. We need to coalesce. We need to join hands together again and create a unified political front. At the time, I don't think the Trump administration even registered it. I don't think it was even a blip on their radar screen. And by the way, for good reason, because the Palestinians have, you know, vowed to reconcile multiple times. It's failed multiple times. It's never come to fruition. So nothing happens. There's no response. And then in January, Biden wins and the Biden administration starts messaging that they support these elections. And we see it begin to gather some momentum. The problem was that Hamas was going to take part in these elections. Hamas is a recognized terrorist organization here in the United States. It's a foreign terrorist organization, FTO, designated by the Treasury. And there are laws in the books here in the United States, some that were spearheaded by a guy you may have heard of named Senator Joe Biden, that said that if Hamas takes part in these elections, you're going to see a cutoff in American funding and you're going to see a cutoff in political recognition. And so a crisis was brewing. I actually talked to a handful of Biden administration officials saying, guys, don't do this. This is a huge mistake. You let Hamas in, it's going to have a ripple effect. It's going to actually delegitimize the Palestinian government. You're going to be in crisis mode. Don't do it. The response that I heard was, hey, look what happened to us on January 6th. We have a flawed democracy. We can't tell other people how to hold elections or how to run their government, which was disingenuous, I think, at best. At any rate, I don't think my pleas moved them a centimeter, but I think that after some time, they probably started to hear from the Israelis, almost certainly from the Israelis, from some of the more pragmatic Arab states saying, guys, cut it out. Don't do it. Let's call upon the Palestinians to cancel this. So finally, at the very last minute, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, announces that the elections are canceled. Hamas is furious, as you would expect them to be. They were set to take part, and now they're blocked from these elections, and they had no recourse, right? There was no way to win back the hearts and minds of the Palestinians by way of the ballot box. So what does a terrorist group do to put themselves front and center again in the minds of Palestinians? Well, they start a war. This was, in my view, the reason why the war erupted. It got no coverage here in the United States. By the way, I would just say that in the United States, most people don't even realize that Palestinians have that political divide that I mentioned, let alone that they would launch wars against Israel in order to cement their position politically among the population. But in my view, that was likely what prompted the war, was Hamas's desire to win back the hearts and minds and to position themselves as the leaders of the Palestinian cause. And I'll just say as a postscript, they succeeded. They took all the oxygen out of the room. At the end of the war, no one was talking about the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Everyone was talking about Hamas and their position inside the Gaza Strip. And so it's actually led to the United States and Israel and other countries doing what they can to try to shore up the strength of the PA.
I want to pivot back to the media and its role here. We're now in a networked age where social media and platforms like Twitter play an outsized role in shaping perceptions. This conflict wasn't any different. What role did social media play in telling or in spinning what was happening on the ground?
So I can tell you what I saw, and then I can tell you kind of how the environment looked from, let's say, 10,000 feet. First of all, there were some interesting debates that I got into with people who I thought were reasonable on this issue, and I've since changed my opinion. People that were denying the role of Iran in the outbreak of the violence and the actions of Hamas, when we know that Iran has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in training and everything else. And so it was remarkable to see people dismiss the role of Iran. I think purely for the optics of the Palestinians, it becomes a deeply bitter issue. No one's really agnostic on this on Twitter, as you can probably imagine. So there was some of that, which I found shocking. You know, I wouldn't find it shocking from the dyed-in-the-wool Palestinian partisan activists on Twitter, but to see people that would normally be somewhat sane take this position, I found somewhat shocking. And you could see some of the shifts that took place within the blue check types, which to me was interesting and very revealing. I had a really interesting personal experience where I was watching Israeli TV and there was an announcement made by the Israeli Defense Ministry and intelligence apparatus where they said that in light of what was going on in the war, Israel vowed to take action against any of Hamas's supporters or activists inside the Gaza Strip and beyond. So the implication was that, you know, this could be a conflict that extends into other jurisdictions. And so I noted on Twitter that there were obvious implications for Iran, Qatar, Turkey, and Malaysia. Within minutes, I started to receive hundreds of angry tweets from Malaysians. And those hundreds of tweets turned to thousands, and those thousands exceeded 10,000. I was being attacked by a Twitter troll army. And, you know, I muted a lot of the tweets. I found the words that, you know, were common. I don't speak Malaysian. I don't know what half of what they were saying to me. But I kept tweeting and I just ignored what came through. But what was so interesting to me afterwards, and we did a little bit of research into this, turns out that was actually directed by the Malaysian government. That was a state-sponsored troll army attack. And so there was a lot of that going on. There were efforts going on, and I'll just broaden out now. There were efforts that were going on to try to remove people, the deplatform people from Facebook, from Twitter, from Instagram. So there was that war that was taking place, and that was like a ground game, right? It was a ground war, tactical stuff, just trying to take out one soldier at a time from the battlefield. You know, and then there was just the disinformation that we saw. After the Jala Tower episode, there would be a couple of NGOs that came out in support of AP or Al Jazeera or the Palestinians writ large. And, you know, you start to see waves of tweets, kind of viral messaging, if you will, condemning the Israelis for, you know, what they were describing as efforts to quell the quash the media or to engage in war crimes. So you could see it on a micro level, at a macro level, tactically, strategically. These are tools that are being used right now to great effect. I don't think the Israelis quite get what they're up against, or maybe they do, but they just don't see the need to engage with, let's just say, individual accounts. They went about their business. They tried to fight the war that mattered to them, which was to safeguard their own people. And then I think afterwards, they tried to set the record straight. They tried to engage in some of those PR battles. But I think there is a question about order of battle. I mean, when you start to do those things after the war is over, will you see success? I'm not sure that the Israelis understand how much damage was probably done during the war and how little effect they had when it was all said and done.
And we'll come back to that because I want to pick your brain about Israel and public diplomacy and their strategy or lack thereof. Let me ask you this. What you're describing isn't exactly a new problem. International reporting on the Palestinian-Israeli confrontation has been bad and it's been unbalanced for a long time. And it tends to trend in a predictable and distinctly anti-Israeli direction. What do you think contributes to that bias? Why is the media so predictable in its coverage?
Look, part of it is the sort of David and Goliath kind of a thing that, you know, there was a time where Israel was the David and the Arab world was the Goliath. And I think the coverage, maybe it wasn't reversed, but it was maybe more balanced than what we see today. Today, because Israel is the stronger party, it's a developed country, it's relatively wealthy by Middle Eastern standards. They have a professional military. And by the way, the Israeli defense systems that they have protect the lives of Israelis. So you see far fewer casualties during these rounds of conflict. And I think that plays into the kind of media narrative that we see. But I would say that this round of conflict in particular, we saw new things emerge. The heavy involvement of American legislators in the debates was actually remarkable to me. You know, generally speaking, members of Congress will come out and sort of, you know, condemn or praise Israel or, you know, condemn Hamas, or sometimes just keep their mouths shut during this, knowing that there may be no win to be had as a politician. But we saw members of Congress, the progressive members of Congress in particular, who I now affectionately call the Hamas caucus, they were actively trying to, I mean, engage as detractors of Israel. And they set the tone for a lot of the media coverage. It sparked additional tweets and social media activity, which is, of course, then picked up on by the mainstream press. And so it became even more of a circus environment. But I have to say that, you know, getting back to the report about that metro system attack, I think there is something to note here. And that is that the media that is deployed to Israel and Gaza to cover these conflicts, they come with their own agendas. I think they come with the preconceived ideas of what sells here in the United States. So in other words, rather than sort of following what happens in the Israeli press, and I'll just say the Israeli media is top notch. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, these are incredibly serious journalists that are not spreading Zionist propaganda. These are people that are only too happy to topple a sitting government, right? To unearth, you know, rape cases that can be pinned on a sitting Israeli president. I mean, they don't mess around. These are sort of Watergate type stories that come out of Israel on a regular basis. They had journalists that were stalking former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on corruption while he was in office. And it was like, you know, it was an albatross around Netanyahu's neck. These guys are not messing around. And there is a conscious decision, I think, to ignore what the Israeli media runs with the idea that there are other stories that they think will appeal to their audiences at home. Generally, those stories lean left. Generally, those stories are anti-Israel. And I would say that there has been more and more momentum in that direction over recent years. Why? I'm not sure exactly. Some people would say it's anti-Semitism. Some people would say that it's just the kind of anti-Israel animus that we see among academics and woke left, if you will. I don't know if I could put my finger on it exactly, but the trend lines are very clear.
All right. So here's the $64,000 question. What is Israel doing about this? The constant refrain we hear is that Israel is bad as Hasbarah, as public diplomacy is known in Hebrew. Why? Why does the Israeli government so often struggle to get its perspectives across in this new media environment?
Look, first, I think it's important to note Hasbarah, actually, the translation for it in English, it's actually explaining. And in a debate, if you are explaining, you are losing. And I think that that's probably point number one. If they are explaining, and especially if they're explaining after the fact, they're going to lose. So I think there is a component of, you know, how does Israel engage more proactively? Why they don't do it, I don't know. But here's what I would say, that if Israel was smart, it would be explaining now in advance of the next round of conflict, how they fight wars, right? There have been four of these Gaza wars one in 2009, one in 2012, another one in 2014, and then this one in 2021. They are very predictable. They begin with Hamas amassing weaponry, and the Israelis track where they're building those weapons and where they store those weapons, and they create what is called a target bank. And that target bank is approved by lawyers inside the Israel Defense Force and inside Israel's Ministry of Justice. So they are constantly collecting intelligence and getting approval for whenever an attack is necessary on these specific sites. Now, while this is all happening, Hamas fires rockets. They send explosive balloons. That's another sort of new tactic. And the Israelis absorb most of those. They don't respond to every attack. But then there will come a time where Hamas does trip the red line, if you will, of Israel, where they fire at Jerusalem, Israel's capital. They fire at the Don region, the area, the sort of slender waistline of Israel, if you will, on the Mediterranean coast, the highly populated areas. And that's usually what triggers the Israelis to respond, at which point they begin to attack that target bank, and then they begin to deplete it over time. Usually the wars begin to, you can feel the cadence begin to drop after that target bank is depleted and after Hamas rockets have been largely destroyed, and you can begin to feel how the war will come to an end. It's at that point that ceasefire talks begin in earnest, usually brokered by the Egyptians or the United States. Just even beginning to explain this to people, but they can see that there is an utter predictability to these conflicts, I think is so important for the Israelis to begin to engage on. But then there's also the precision nature of Israeli strikes, the way that they don't target civilians, the way that they warn in advance of strikes that are coming, as they did with the Jala Tower, the way that they kept the most recent conflict, they kept the casualties down to a little bit over 200 over the course of 11 days, during which Hamas fired 4,000 rockets and Israel responded with roughly three times that in their own munitions. They were so precise that they were able to keep casualties down to a very low number. And they don't explain how they do all of this. They don't explain their war room. They don't allow journalists to come into the war room to see how incredibly sophisticated it is, how incredibly computerized it is, and how they work through these legal structures to keep these conflicts contained. And I think that's a huge missed opportunity for the Israelis. The other part of it is, of course, the state sponsorship element of all of this. To explain that you're fighting a terrorist group, you know, you're going to have people say, well, you know, they're freedom fighters. They're a liberation movement, and you're not going to win that battle. But if you can explain that or show, prove with receipts, with evidence, with video that Hamas is actually the beneficiary of the largesse of Iran, of Turkey, of Qatar, of Malaysia, you begin to show that this is a proxy war against Israel. And then it doesn't really feel like David and Goliath anymore. It feels like something else, something far more nefarious. And I think the Israelis have missed opportunity after opportunity to demonstrate what it does, how it does it, where its enemy gets its support from. If they did that more proactively and they did it more often, I think they could start to turn the tide. One caveat, of course, is that especially here in the United States, our media environment is bonkers. I think that's the right word. We don't care anymore right now about foreign policy. The headlines, the stories that I see, it's all domestic. It's Trump. It's January 6th. It's masking. It's vaccines. It's all inward looking. It's all navel gazing. So the question is, could the Israelis even penetrate our media environment to be able to demonstrate some of the things that I'm talking about? And I think the answer could be no. What's frustrating is that 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was probably more feasible, but they didn't take advantage of it. So the question is, has that window closed? When will it reopen? I don't know.
but I guess the Israelis maybe one day could try to find out.
John, thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure, Ilan. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.